You are listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then saw that all that was emptiness and attained nirvana. Our question for episode 27, does reality have a foundation at all? With readings by the 2nd century Buddhist philosopher Nagarjuna, including Reasoning, the 60 stanzas, and Emptiness, the 70 stanzas. You can find a link to these and other readings, plus other entertaining things, at our blog, partiallyexaminedlife.com. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer, multi-classing a 5th-level bodhisattva and a 3rd-level rogue in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, aspiring merely to attain virtuous action in Austin, Texas.
And this is Eric Douglas, out of England's sadly missing Wes.
Yes, Wes is a sick boy. He had nothing to say anyway. He's attained nirvana. Say that. We have some rules for our discussion, but when I look upon them, I see only emptiness. Let me give them nonetheless, because they are conventionally true. Number one, we try not to assume our audience is fully enlightened about philosophy, or has even heard the Steely Dan song Bodhisattva. Number two, we will not do the name-dropping thing, except when we feel like it. We will say what we mean instead of saying, all enlightened beings should know what I'm talking about, for they have surely read Carl Jung's masterwork. The collective unconscious says you must make the love to me. Number three, we shall be rigorous and exact in all that we say, except for Eric, who as guest is allowed to blither away nonsensically and unendingly.
I don't remember that exception ever being provided before for any other guest.
So, yes, Buddhism.
For this particular episode, we had a specific reading by a specific author. Since Buddhism is kind of a very broad term, maybe it would make sense to kind of explain what this particular guy, this isn't the Buddha. We didn't read the Buddha, right? We read it, somebody who was attempting to explicate certain aspects of the Buddha's teachings.
Yes, we did not read the Buddha. The Buddha is from around 563 to 400 BC. People think maybe. And this guy that we read is more like 150 to 250 AD, somewhere in there. And they're not clear on either of them. And Buddha didn't actually write anything anyway. Oral tradition.
We were originally talking about doing an episode on Zen, right?
Yes, it being the coolest, most Western one.
Most definitely. It's so hip. So when we started to think about that, we realized that, never mind Zen, what was Buddhism? And then when we thought about Buddhism, we kept sort of going backwards because we were thinking Zen, then go back to China with Chan Buddhism, then take a step back behind that to Mahayana Buddhism, take a step back behind that, we get to the Buddha, and then we took a half a step up and we got to Nagarjuna.
Now you pronounce it Nagarjuna?
That's the way I learned it at school.
Okay. I listened to a YouTube video where the guy actually said Nagarjuna as opposed to Nagarjuna. Narjuna.
Maybe it's the English thing. I don't know.
Who knows? Maybe this guy didn't know what he was talking about. And it had flute music in the background, so it must be authentic.
Let's not get hung up on pronunciations like we did. I think early episode, somebody was complaining about the way we were pronouncing German names.
That happened after we did, folks that listened to our Taoism episode on Chuangzi will recognize Eric. He was our guest last time. And after that, somebody came down on us and said, how could you do a whole episode and talk for 3 hours and not even know how to pronounce the guy's name? Chuang Tzu, because that's how I heard it in my classes.
Yeah, and that one at least was transliterated into pretty standard English. There are accent marks on tops of letters on this thing that I have no idea how to pronounce. So I won't make any apologies for what might come out of my mouth this episode.
I want to know how the Nagas pronounce his name. That's what I want to know.
Ah, actually, we should talk about the Naga story for just a second.
Absolutely. So,
Nagarjuna means lover of snakes, right? Lover of sea snakes, of the Nagas. The Nagas are magical sea snake beings that were popular in the mythology of the time. And so he was regarded as passing on some secret teachings of the Buddha that hadn't leaked out before. And so the explanation of why these were so secret is because the Nagas, the snake people, listened to Buddha talk. And in fact, I read some of the Lotus Sutra, I think. Maybe, Eric, you pointed me out that one, which I guess was kind of current at the time. Probably Nagarjuna would have read that, right?
Some variation of it. I don't know when they put the actual Lotus Sutra together. But, of course, yeah. The Lotus Sutra and the sutras like that are actually supposed to be expositories from the Buddha himself.
Yes, it would start it off as a big speech from the Buddha, and the whole first chapter was, here's everybody that was there. Must have been 5,000 people and all the kings and the gods, and they were all gathered around and listening to the Buddha, and the Nagas were there, and they're all, and all these other magical beings are hanging around cheering for the next awesome thing that the Buddha is going to say. It's pretty over the top. And so the Nagas apparently learned some things from the Buddha that the humans at the time, they weren't prepared for. And so they had to wait for someone wise enough to be born to pass on this special teaching. And then when Nagarjuna showed up, he was so evidently wise that they took him to their undersea kingdom and taught him the core doctrines of interdependent origination and other things that are special to the Mahayana school or associated with Nagarjuna.
I learned a slightly different variation. So Nagarjuna, sorry, I don't know if I can stop pronouncing him that way. And all the snake people that are offended, I'm very, very sorry, especially. So Nagarjuna was a very cheeky person, apparently. The story goes with him, too, that when he was young, he broke in with some friends into the king's harem and attempted to seduce the king's mistress. They were almost successful, but they kind of all got caught. He managed to just escape. All his friends got their heads cut off. And because of that, he saw how impermanent life was and vowed not to follow the paths of desire anymore. He did such a good job of it that the Nagas were very impressed with him and eventually invited him to their undersea kingdom, where they had some very special knowledge waiting, which had come from the Buddha and which they then passed on to him. Now, the reason that that knowledge had not been brought out before his time was not so much that they were waiting for this very special person, but because humanity as a whole was not ready. The idea is that Buddha has this sort of incredible awakening, and then he brings out these teachings, but people really aren't ready to hear most of his teaching right off the bat. And so a whole lot of the teaching is putatively stored with these various places and people. And this is not the only instance where this happens. And the idea is that this knowledge then gets brought out to all the people at the right time. Now, what this sort of corresponds to is then also a very major split in Buddhism that happens, a little bit like the Reformation, that originally Buddhism appears, whatever you said, 500 BC, give or take 100 years. Yep. And then over the next several hundred years, say like with Christianity, you have many schools, many versions of Buddhism begin to form. Then 200 or so BC or 100 AD, it's not clear, there's this major upheaval and this split in a fundamental doctrine. And this corresponds to Nagarjuna and the receiving of this wisdom. And that's, of course, why we've now kind of focused on Nagarjuna, is because it's sort of a major branch and split off.
Yes. So you're talking about the rising of the Mahayana tradition.
Right. Which means great vehicle. And the correspondent term is Hinayana. But Hinayana, which means lesser vehicle, is actually a term only used by Mahayana people.
Right.
Surprise, surprise.
That there are non-Mahayana traditions alive. There's like the Theravada, that is sometimes associated with Hinayana, but not really. That whatever they're objecting to and that they call the Hinayana school really doesn't exist anymore.
The Theravada, they don't all regard that as a very nice name. So they don't use the name. But yeah, essentially, Theravada is the alternative. All of the Buddhisms that you find south of the Himalayas. So all of them in Sri Lanka, India, Cambodia, Southeast Asia, everywhere there, that's all Theravada Buddhism.
Okay.
All right. And Theravada was actually one school of the many schools that belonged to traditional Orthodox Buddhism. And when Islam came to India in about 700 or 800, whenever it was, and it just swept like a wave, they destroyed Buddhism. They killed everybody and destroyed all the temples. So the Buddhism got wiped out of India, everything south of the Himalayas, unless you go to Sri Lanka.
Right. And the texts we are reading are most, if not all, translated from Tibetan.
Right.
They're written in Sanskrit, but in a lot of cases, these texts don't even exist anymore in the original Sanskrit.
Right.
So all types of Buddhism is the realization that life sucks. We must escape life somehow. We must escape the endless cycle of death and rebirth, right? With the whole reincarnation thing was around hundreds of years, at least before Buddha, with the Vedas, right? Mm-hmm. This was an old belief. This is relevant to why Western philosophers would care about it in the first place. Like if you read Schopenhauer is a philosopher who was influenced directly by Buddhist writings, and the thing that he reacted to was what he saw as pessimism in it. So whether you believe in reincarnation or not, life is mostly suffering, right? Even if something good is going on, the way that we are constructed is such that, and you can think of this back to Freud from last time, that we are constructed in a way that happiness cannot be permanent for us, that we are forever at need, and that just overall things in the environment are going to go against us, that even if we have a happy, comfortable life, well, there's going to be suffering and death. It's all going to be meaningless from that respect. So the enlightened person will want to get out of this somehow. And Buddha supposedly discovered a way to do this through meditation, through transcendence of this material plane.
Buddha comes around, he gives a whole lot of sermons after sort of having this great realization, this truth. What's in a way fundamentally philosophically interesting is that he throws away all kinds of notions that had been around up to his time. A lot of traditional metaphysics, a lot of traditional polytheist views. It's very difficult to say exactly what he's saying with respect to what kind of religion is it, or if it is even a religion. However, the fundamental teaching that he espouses is called the Four Noble Truths. These are four fundamental truths that provide the absolute foundation to Buddhism and everything that follows. The first is that suffering is the real nature of our lives. The second noble truth is that it has a cause. It arises through the accumulation of karma.
Or more loosely, actually, I'm just looking at one version of it on the web. The origin of suffering is attachment. So it's the fact that we have desires at all.
Sure.
Right, is what causes us suffering. We make ourselves suffer.
What do you have there for the third one?
The cessation of suffering is attainable.
Right. So there's a way out of this nasty little prison. And the fourth noble truth is the way that one needs to follow in order to get out of that prison. And the fourth one then breaks up into what's sometimes called the Eightfold Path, which is the sort of eight methods you can use to actually get out of it. But it's all very cool and actually kind of practical and useful in sort of a day-to-day life way.
I do think that just the way that the Eightfold Path is stated are almost circular. So the Eightfold Path is stuff like right view, right speech, right intention, right action. In other words, it's not telling you what, it's not characterizing in any way what the right view is, what the right speech is. It's just make sure that you're paying attention to all these things, your mindfulness, your concentration, your action, your livelihood, your effort. Pretty much you need to remake yourself as a person into something else to break away from this ordinary way that people live, which is being dominated by their passions.
Okay, well, there are some things that have been written about this.
Well, certainly. Certainly.
But what is fair to say is that all Buddhism believe in the Four Noble Truths and their thumbs up to the Eightfold Path. And once you get into the details of, well, exactly how you do right speech and right action and all that sort of stuff, then you'll start to find some subtle variations and different views and schools. So
the goal is for each person to follow this Eightfold Path, to meditate, and so attain nirvana, which is escape from the cycle of rebirth. And for the old-time Buddhists, that was it. You get out, you become an arhat, right? That's the enlightened one, I believe, is the term.
The arhat is a Vedic notion.
This is getting dangerously close to throwing out too many words. That was the one thing about reading the text, is that there's like, oh, and you must, of course, believe in the triple gem and the sabahana and this and that. There's just so much jargon.
You're right, Seth.
We will restrain ourselves.
Enlightened, whether it's Vedic or arhat or whatever, just
we will not tell what the four fruits are, what the the six realms. There's a lot of lists of things.
Yes, there are
words in.
Oh, let's do the six realms. They're fun. I like that one.
Actually, I do want to make fun of that for a minute, because we were talking about the cycle of rebirth, that part of this was that there are all these different worlds that you could be born into. And in fact, even if, if you're really good, maybe you'll go into a heaven. But then, like, what do you do in this heaven? And this is different than nirvana. This is one of the other six realms, is, well, you'll just lie around and accumulate bad karma essentially in the heaven. And so you'll end up in one of the hells again. So even if your life here or your anticipated life in this heaven is going well, for sure, you're going to be reborn enough times that you'll end up in some bad places. And there are a few of the realms that are hells, or the realm of hungry ghosts and other stuff like this. So that there's a lot packed in there.
Strictly speaking, right? You're really talking about a school of Buddhism called Vajrayana. I'm not sure the other Buddhisms actually advocate the six realms.
It's mentioned in...
I don't think that Zen does. I don't think that Zen Buddhism does. Or if they do, I mean, you will find authors who refer to it as a metaphor. I mean, this is the same concept of, you know, what the hell do you mean by hell in the Christian context when you look at all the different sects and you find they have very different conceptions of what Sheol or whatever the hell the Hebrew term is, like what that refers to. So there's not a sort of one set of reincarnated realms fits all.
Now that you mentioned, I'm not sure if I saw that reference in the Nagarjuna reading or in one of the commentaries.
When Buddhism appeared, the context was two parts. One was there was the Vedic religions, and the other was that there was the Vedic philosophies.
Vedic religions is like the parent religion of Hinduism. Right?
Basically, it's Hinduism, but the whole Hinduism is like this massive pantheon where if you come along and you have a different religion, they'll go, cool, another god, and they incorporate it in. And that means Jesus, and that means you name it. I mean, they just keep growing. And they accept Buddha, and they're good with it all. And one of the fundamental concepts in Vedic theology is that, nevertheless, you can, if you're really good, and you're a Brahmin class, right, remember, and you're male, you can actually attain a state of perfection where you get to go and hang out with, you know, Vishnu and these groovy gods and be enlightened, you know, term that you hear often.
Okay, so even the term of enlightenment was kind of already in the Vedic tradition.
It's in the yogic, all the traditions, okay. You know, Maharaji, yogi, this, that, and the other. They all have this notion of enlightenment. Sometimes they call it illuminated, sometimes they call it transcended, you know, however you want to translate it from the Sanskrit. This fundamental notion of some profound spiritual attainment is possible. And to some extent, at least some Buddhists will claim, okay, this was a move away from that into a different way of engaging and dealing. Among other things, you know, it's not sufficient simply that you worship some gods and that they tap you on the shoulder and then off you go. That the whole notion of liberation, which is the operative term for enlightenment in Buddhism, happens through a very specific methodology and way. It was trying to dispel a whole lot of ritual, a whole lot of doctrine, and also a whole lot of philosophy. And one of the things to bear in mind in this is that, you know, as sophisticated as Greece was in the Axial Age, in those sort of few hundred years from whatever, 600 BC to 300 BC, that same period saw a similar flowering in India, where you had umpteen philosophers writing extraordinary texts. The first text of grammar was written at this time in Sanskrit, you know. But one very important difference is that there's a sense in which theology and philosophy didn't suffer the kind of separation it seems to have. At least when we look at, you know, Greece from this modern day, we say, oh, well, there was, of course, they believed in various gods, but they had their philosophy and those two were different. You never had that separation in the East, neither in India nor in China. Philosophy and theology were never properly separatable. Does that sound right to you guys?
It's not reflected so much in what we read, which is, for the most part, very secular. It, certainly from the description I gave of the Lotus Sutra, Buddha himself was deified, certainly, in the tradition. Even though one of the things you hear about Buddhism is it's fundamentally atheistic, that there's not, you know, a god underlying everything or something like this, still, anybody that's a hero in any culture pre-modern age is going to be deified at some point. So not only Buddha, but Nagarjuna in this whole story about the sea snakes and stuff like this. So we can do our best to kind of giggle at that and, or, you know, look for the actual philosophical core
right of
what's in there, apart from any dogmatism.
Well, let's not forget, modern China, Mao got deified. Mao, strictly speaking, is a demigod.
Very nice. So. So, Mahayana comes along. I know one of the big differences was just the idea that instead of just trying to escape the cycle of birth and redeath, you want to have compassion and come back and help other people and become a bodhisattva. That's the new goal, that you're not trying to just, it's not nihilistic, you're not just trying to escape everything. You're trying to bring everybody else to enlightenment so that ultimately the goal is that every single soul that exists would be enlightened, not just you trying to get out of there.
Well, we got the Buddha, it sort of comes out of this Vedic context, and then bad Vedic habits creeped back into Buddhism over the several hundred years that followed Buddha. And this is where Nagarjuna then enters the picture and where you then have this sort of equivalent of a reformation happen. And the idea is to sort of purify and get back to what Buddha was talking about and not to have all this new doctrine, new rituals. At least this is the claim of what are then many Mahayana Buddhists. And in many respects, Nagarjuna is the person that is pointed to as sort of the Luther, you know, mm-hmm. of this reformation.
I guess one of the things that I had heard growing up about Buddhism is that, oh, they don't believe in God, they believe in the void. That if you look what's underneath all of the physical things that you see, your idea of yourself is profound nothingness. So in other words, there is an ontology, a list of things that are, but what is in it is this void, which is, you know, you might as well call it the Tao. Whereas reading this, it seemed it was a lot more subtle than that. This pure nothingness, because that sounds like a very nihilistic philosophy. And because if you really think that, why pursue ethical action? I mean, you might say there's the Eightfold Path because, oh, I have to be selfless to people because I want to attain nirvana. I want to get away from my urges that are bringing me suffering. And so therefore I should be ethical. But there's no reason. It's not that I actually have a responsibility to other people because ultimately those other people are not real. And I'm not real. This knife that I'm stabbing you with is not real. And the raping that's going on next door is not real. So it really undermines, it's a very self-defeating sort of philosophy to really take seriously the idea that all is void. This is all just illusion.
Well, I think that's more of a Western trivialization. I found in my experience that I mostly hear that talking to Christians, you know, who just utterly don't understand, you know, what's going on.
Well, I just wanted to voice that
enough. And it's also partly due to folks like Schopenhauer. And if you look at the way people take Nietzsche, of course, you know, they say, oh, he's a nihilist. He doesn't believe in anything. And I was like, well, and maybe sit down and read the book first or something.
Let me throw something in here then. This idea of that Mark just mentioned of nothingness and a Western view of, well, if you're going to try to tell people to act a certain way, if you're going to try to give them an ethical system or give them a morality, there has to be something that backs it up, that underlies it. And so we have a very well-developed metaphysics that underlies the ethical system that we accept in the West. And because we have that, when we look at these other cultures, we say, oh, well, if you're going to tell me to act a certain way, then you're going to have to somehow justify telling me to do that. So for our view, simplistically, we say, well, the goal is to get to the afterlife, the kingdom of heaven. And the way you do that is by living a virtuous life here on this earth. And the reason you want to do that is because God tells you to do it. And we have this whole series of steps we go through. And so I think we're looking for a similar kind of structure in Buddhism to say, oh, well, here, yeah, you want to live a virtuous life because the goal is to get to this point, which we call liberation or nirvana or whatever. And here's how it's underwritten by this metaphysics. What was interesting to me about this text and about trying to understand this was, in a weird way, the goal is not virtue, right action. The goal is liberation, which seems to me somehow qualitatively different than attaining the kingdom of heaven or the afterlife or whatever. And it's not the same as virtue ethics, because although virtue is important in the system, it's not the end goal. Being a virtuous person is not all there is to it. The goal is getting out of this cycle of rebirth. That just seems to me to be something fundamentally different than what I can relate to as a Westerner in kind of Western religious tradition.
Properly speaking, this divide is not so much Buddhism, but East and West. This is the difference, I would say, more between just the Vedic religions altogether and the Western religions. Fundamental to Judaism is this notion of a relationship with the personalized God. And fundamental to the Vedic religions is this notion that you're in life. This is weird, but there's a way out of suffering. There's a way to achieve an enlightenment. And then Buddha is just one specific flavor of that.
If you do see the attainment of heaven and the attainment of nirvana as analogous in any way, attaining nirvana, it's not a matter of divine grace. It's a matter of getting your mind to function in a certain way, to detach itself from desire, to see the ultimate lack of grounding of things. And maybe ethical action is part of what you have to do to train yourself, to get yourself on the way to that. And again, there's also the idea that once you attain nirvana for the Mahayana view, Nagarjuna is among them, then you don't actually want to escape yourself yet. You want to help everybody else escape first. So that requires that you stick around acting selflessly and lead a very ethical life. But it's still you doing it. It's not God granting you a favor.
The claim by the Mahayana Buddhist is that Buddhism was becoming re-corrupted by bad metaphysics. And part of that led to this notion that as a Buddhist, you could basically do the Vedic thing and become an arhat, you know, a liberated person. Now, one of the fundamental principles in Mahayana Buddhism is actually, it's not an option to become enlightened. It's not an option to become liberated. These are not actually possibilities, really, that are there for you. It's a being. You've got a body, you've got form, you've got ego. There's no getting away from it. The best you can actually do is to quit collecting it. And ultimately in Zen, this becomes very important because what Zen people then call enlightenment isn't sort of necessarily this ultimate state. Now, there's a story, and this is a mythological story about the Buddha. It said that, you know, after he worked for lifetimes and lifetimes, doing all sorts of wonderful things like offering himself up as a sacrifice to a tiger because he felt pity for a hungry tiger and said, well, go ahead and eat me. Lifetimes of good deeds, right? And they did all this work. And eventually, he actually arrives at what is in this context termed heaven. And from within heaven, he hears voices saying, hey, we've been waiting for you. And he's reputed to have said, how could I actually enter heaven and leave all these people that are still in samsara?
Samsara being the cycle of birth and death.
Or all of illusionary reality, or many ways of talking about samsara. But he's supposedly about to get the big enlightenment. He says, no, I can't do this. Now, there's two views on that. One is ethical. I can't do this because my compassion, like Jesus, right, pulls me back to the world, and I must seek out the liberation and the cessation of suffering for all sentient beings. There's also a metaphysical take on it, which is, this is not possible. It's ontologically impossible to attain a state of enlightenment, because enlightenment intrinsically is a unified state. And as long as you have beings that are not in an enlightened state, then the whole cannot be enlightened. And the only thing that can meaningfully be enlightened is the whole. This is a fundamental departure from the traditional Vedic thinking. Because all of a sudden, you know, hey, even that's been taken off the table. There is no escape from this. The option that they leave you with is this notion of being a bodhisattva, which is being a being who's made a promise to sort of go against the grain and try and cause a cessation of suffering and help sentient beings, but is not actually enlightened.
Buddha in training.
Yeah, but Buddha in training for yet many more lifetimes. And, you know, you get texts on how many lifetimes.
All right, now Tutankhamun, right. Finally. He's the founder of this early school within the Mahayana tradition, which is
Madhyamika.
Okay, Madhyamika is how I was initially pronouncing it. The same video was Madhyamika, like Hanukkah, to make me think of that. So what this means is the view of the middle way, something like that. And the reason it's called the middle way, and in fact, one of their big texts, which is one that we skimmed for today, is the foundation stanzas of the middle way, or also translated as verses from the center. But it's the middle way is between seeing everything as real, right? So it's the things of your experience have this absolute reality, and that's just what reality is, objective scientific reality. And this nihilism of, no, everything is illusory. What's ultimately real is nothingness. He's trying to go between those two, the middle way. And the way he does that is to say, it's not that things don't really exist. It's that these phenomena that we encounter in our experience, they have emptiness. So they do not have inherent existence. You do not have, I'm going to use another word, svabhava, this inherent existence. I mean, you could say objective existence, but that doesn't quite capture it because we have phenomenologists or pragmatists. We've already even discussed in some of these episodes the idea of, you know, if both of us are in a room and I drop a rock on the ground and you see it fall and I see it fall, it seems like that rock and what it just did has objective existence just because it has intersubjective verifiability. And for scientific purposes, that's all you need. But that's not to say maybe we're in the matrix, right? So it has an objective existence in that it's a part of the program, part of our shared delusion, but it's not real in a way that the philosopher would want it to be. You could still wake up from the matrix and see that it was all bogus. So I think the matrix works very well as an image for what Nagarjuna sees our reality. I mean, he talks about dreams a lot and compares our experiences to the, yeah, okay, you could talk that there was an object in that dream. You could describe there was a chair, it was red, it has properties, it caused something else to happen. But you're still talking about a dream, right? So there's conventional reality, which is what he calls all this, and it still has cause and effect. You could still do science, and there's still ethical implications. But ultimately under that is the ultimate reality, which is the recognition of the underlying. But you don't even want to say it's nothingness, because that's making a positive metaphysical statement that is contradicting the metaphysical statement of the solidity of the things in front of us. So it's something else. It's some kind of escape. It's really recognition of emptiness is the true reality.
Emptiness is not the same thing as nothingness, because nothingness implies that there could be a something. And emptiness is somehow supposed to be a neutral term where there's not a full and an empty. There's just simply emptiness.
This is where it gets very hard to talk about.
I think nothingness is a very poorly chosen term. I think that actually one of the reasons that, for example, in the translations that we were looking at, that the term emptiness is used is precisely for that reason. Nothingness is a distinct term, especially in the context of Nargujana's writings here. Emptiness is not a dichotomy.
Yes, that's kind of the key points, is that middle way, in a kind of way, it's a solution to the problem of being and becoming. That if you look at the Western tradition and you see all the people who deal with the issue of being and non-being, particularly when we start talking about them as predicates, you know, trying to say like something does mm-hmm. not exist. Like, what is that something, and how do we talk about it not existing, and how is existence a predicate, and all that sort of thing. But even going back to our episode on quantum physics, when we talked about the pre-Socratics, you know, there was a real issue with trying to understand the concept of change and whether or not there were actual things that became other things, or if everything was static and you were just getting different properties or experiences of them and all that. And this middle way is a way of trying to address that problem. At least that's the way I read it.
Just in support of this, at the beginning of the 70 stanzas translation, in the preface, who is the translator? I forget. Komito, David Komito. He says the whole purpose of Buddhist logic is that you're trying to find a way to talk about and explain the dynamic aspect of that things change, that things aren't permanent. Precisely that. That is the whole point of Buddhist logic.
Which page are you talking about there, Eric?
He's talking in the Komito, which is a secondary source. Let me just describe what it is we looked at. So if you look on our website, partiallyexaminedlife.com, you'll see two hyperlinks. One of them is to a PDF that has four different readings by Nagarjuna in it. Two of them are this Emptiness, the 70 stanzas, and Reasoning, the 60 stanzas. And they're very terse when you read them by themselves. But each of those has, also in the same PDF, a commentary. And one of these is by Chandrakirti, who is 600 to 650 AD, I have for Chandrakirti. The other commentary in that document is supposedly by Nagarjuna himself. That's how it's labeled. There's a lot of dispute whether he actually wrote that commentary. Now, why somebody would even thinkably write a commentary on his own stuff is because the central verses of these are supposed to be verses, like that you could memorize them, you could sing them. So it's not that crazy that in Emptiness the 70 stanzas, you might have, here's my one sentence that's the verse, and now I'll give a commentary for a couple more sentences about it. And then there's also a couple other things in that PDF, one of which talks about his ethical views. Now, beyond that PDF, we will also link to the text I referred to, which is the Verses from the Center, also called the Foundational Verses of the Middle Way. And this is a much longer and puzzling document that, to my mind, is very internally repetitious, but it's kind of regarded as the core writing of Nagarjuna. Besides that, we took a look at two secondary sources, at least to some extent. One of them was another translation of the Emptiness of 70 Stanzas by David Ross Komito. And that, as well as having a much different translation, he like worked with a guy in Tibet to give a new commentary on it. So this reflects sort of Tibetan oral tradition, and also has a very long introduction that discusses Buddhist psychology. So it's kind of an interesting reading in its own right. And then the last of these secondary sources that we looked at is one called Nagarjuna's Madhyamika by Jan Westerhoff. And that is a conscious attempt to relate Nagarjuna's writings as a whole to Western philosophy and to really explain it. So I got actually much more out of that book than the sources themselves. Or rather, I looked at these secondary sources and then looked back at the primary sources to kind of test myself and say, oh, okay, now I understand what Nagarjuna is talking about. Because it is kind of hard to figure out in verse what some of these, who's Nagarjuna arguing against? What point is he trying to make? Is he just stating a lot of stuff dogmatically, or is he actually giving an argument here? It's hard to tell a lot.
Right. He's, in fact, in many cases, very specifically arguing against very specific people who have published some other set of verses or songs, or however you want to put it. And also, even the formation and the structure of his arguments are following traditional syllogisms. So there's actually, shortly around his time, Indian logic sort of took this giant jump forward and did something a bit like Aristotle. And you actually had these very explicitly laid out forms of debate and forms of legitimate and valid argument. And he uses many of these structures and styles that were common for the era also in the formation of his arguments. This is important to bear in mind when one looks at, you know, tries to read him and make sense of him, is to realize actually he's using proper form for his time. But of course, the logic of the day of India was not exactly the same as Aristotle's syllogisms and modus ponens and all that kind of stuff. They had a different set, corresponding but different.
Can I just give a quote to give an example of this? This is from the same, from The Emptiness, verse 4 of that. The existent does not originate because it is existent. The non-existent does not originate because it is non-existent. The existent and non-existent also does not originate because they are heterogeneous. Because there is no origination, there is no duration, and no destruction. So the form there is make a positive statement and then kind of make a negative version of that, then put them both together and then consider neither. So it's like we're considering all four cases, and usually we discount all of them. And this is called a tetralemma, is the form. And it works in different ways throughout the text, but he does that. In fact, this verses from the center thing is almost entirely that. It's like a chapter will be a tetralemma going into detail about how causality doesn't work this way, but it doesn't work the opposite way, and it doesn't work both those ways together, and it doesn't work neither of those ways. And he just goes through concept by concept by concept to show that everything is emptiness, because the theories that you could come up with about these things, none of them make sense.
Yeah, although it's interesting, I mean, in saying, you know, well, it's neither this, it's not that, it's neither both of them, nor is it neither of them. One of the criticisms that is thrown against Nagarjuna, especially by the Vedic Orthodox and traditionalists, is that he actually makes it his business to only knock down everybody else's theories, it seems, without, at least at first look, offering a positive alternative.
Should we maybe read a few of the first stanzas here of emptiness to try to see how he states it, and then we can talk a little bit about this notion of emptiness?
Sure.
So it's the PDF that has all four things in it: causality and emptiness, the wisdom of Nagarjuna. Part 3, section 3, emptiness, the 70 stanzas. So here's the first verse: duration, origination, destruction, existence, non-existence, inferiority, mediocrity, and superiority were taught by the Buddha in accord with conventional usage, not by the power of the real. Number 2, there is not anything which corresponds to the expressions not self, not not self, both self and not self, because all factors which can be spoken of are, like nirvana, in their intrinsic being empty. So right there, in those two verses, we get this distinction between what is conventionally real, and you can found an ethics on, and you can do science and all this, and what is ultimately real, which is none of these things are ultimately real. And it's interesting that even right here in number 2, he's getting at sort of what's interesting about him. He's saying not only is the self not real, but the concept of not self is itself not real. So if you say people don't have lasting souls, right, that's the concept of a substantial self that Descartes would buy into, or anybody in the Christian tradition. So not only is Nagarjuna denying that, but he's saying that the concept not self is also bogus in some way. What are we to make of that?
What we make of it is that he's trying to point out that, at least this was my understanding, he's trying to point out that if you posit any kind of entity, even the negation of an entity, you're sort of caught up in a kind of language or a kind of ontology that he's trying not to be committed to. So if you say there is a self, then there's an issue. If you say there is no self, you still have the same problem where you're saying, well, what is it that there isn't? Oh, there's not this thing. So he says, to say that there is or there is not appropriate. There's simply emptiness. It's like this term you have to use, this third term, in order to escape the dyad.
Right. Any notions that are opposite depend on each other. So it's this kind of yin-yang thing. That if you say, oh, the only reason that we know what good is because we know what evil is. If there were no evil, there could be no good. And that is the kind of thing that Nagarjuna would say about ethics, that those terms are dependent upon another. And you can't say, for instance, that good is ontologically basis and that evil is just somehow derived from that. That wouldn't make any sense for him. He'd say, no, these terms depend on each other. And so in the same way, self and not self are opposites that depend on each other notionally,
yes.
You could say, right? The ideas themselves depend on each other in the same way.
Yes, that's something that obviously we're very familiar with in the 20th century when you have deconstructionism, I'm not trying to name drop, but postmodern philosophy that looked at these opposing dyads and the terms good versus evil, heaven versus hell, self versus other, and that it's our tendency to prioritize one of those terms when in reality they require each other and there's not one that takes priority mm-hmm. over the other. And it seems to me that he's grasped that concept, at least in some certain way, and that this middle way is an attempt to try to escape conceptually that sort of structure, which I find interesting. Now, what I find interesting about it as well is that we can talk about trying to escape it, but I'm not sure that linguistically we have what it takes to do that. I mean, one of the things is conceptually and in terms of the language that we use, it's almost impossible not to speak that way. And so I can kind of get that he's saying this is what he's trying to do, but at the same time, realizing that just by virtue of talking about it in English the way that we do, it'll be almost impossible to say it or conceptualize it. And certainly our logic and our way of doing reasoning is not going to help us in this case.
I think one of the really interesting things that really stands out with Nargujjana is he very specifically addresses that there are two truths. One of them is sort of this ultimate truth, and the other one is conventional truth. Everything that we talk about here has to be expressed within the context of the conventional truths. It's impossible to speak in terms of these ultimate truths, and nowhere does Nargujjana ever make a claim about ultimate truth. He never says anything about it. He just says it's there. It's a bit like the Taoist reference. You know, there's this real Tao out there, but anything that we say about it is not that real Tao. There's this fundamental wedge that goes right in between the metaphysics and the semantics about the metaphysics.
Right. So you can't say ultimately there is void, there is nothingness, because that too would be a term that has an opposite of somethingness. The Westerhoff distinguished in talking about the logic here between two kinds of negation. So here's an example. If I say the number 7 is red, okay, that's false, but I don't want to say the number 7 is not red, because that implies that there's some other color that it is, right? So red and these other colors form an interdependent conceptual sphere, something like that. But I could say it is not the case that the number 7 is red. That's fine. If you're looking at it in terms of the formal logical structure, it's not that you're saying object A is not P, right, where P is red. You're saying it is not the case, you're putting the not sign in the front, that object P is red. So you can do the same thing. You could say that it seems like we encounter all these material objects in our everyday experience. We don't want to say that, no, it's not that there are material objects, there is instead nothingness, because that's like saying there's not material objects, which is a different kind of ontological claim. What he wants to say is, I'm not going to make an ontological claim. I'm going to say, this ontological claim is false, but I'm not replacing it with the opposite of it. Like you said, there is nothing positive you can say about the ultimate truth. You can just negate the things of conventional truth.
Stanza 44 is a good one that says this. Should I just read it out?
Sure.
Whatever is said by the Buddha has the two truths as its chief underlying thought. It is hard to understand and must be interpreted in this light. When the Buddha says existence, his chief underlying thought is conventional existence. When he says non-existence, his chief underlying thought is non-inherent existence. When he says existence and non-existence, his chief underlying thought is conventional existence and non-inherent existence as a mere object of examination. Okay, this is one of the Tibetan translations. So I know it's just bouncing
yes.
through.
Which are much longer. The version in the other PDF is, there exists the statement of existence and also the statement of non-existence. And again, the statement of both existence and non-existence. The intentional proclamations of the Buddhas are not easily penetrated.
So to kind of get to the point, the key is that there's this issue of existence, at least in a kind of conventional sense, that he needs to escape from. Because existence, non-existence, attributes, properties, substance, all of these things get you caught up in a way of thinking that are ultimately going to prevent you from understanding whatever the critical truth is that you need to understand the noble truths, this affliction. In order to understand that life is suffering or whatever the case may be, part and parcel of it is that you need to escape from this way of thought that there is existence in this traditional sense.
Absolutely. This is probably the most important target of Nargujjana. The reason you can't get liberated or enlightened is because that presupposes substance and soul and identity is something meaningful. And it's the way that, these metaphysics has creeped back into Buddhism that has got us thinking this way and talking this way again. So I'm going back and really, in a way, deconstructing all of what we're doing philosophically so we don't make that mistake.
Yeah, my reading of it is something like this, that if you believe that the good things and the bad things that happen to you, riches and wealth and illness and death and all that, somehow are actually happening to you, and there's a you and there are these other things, you're going to be tied to that you and you're going to be tied to those things. You're going to want to accumulate the good things, avoid the bad things. You're going to want to take care of yourself in the strictest sense of the self and the taking care of. And he says you need to let all that go. And the way to let go of the self, let go of all of these things, is you really literally have to let go of the self and say, there is no I. These things are all impermanent. And what I mean by impermanent is that they're empty. I mean that there is no entity there. There is no it. And that is really tough to grasp. But I think that's the lesson that's being taught here. At least that was the way that I read it out of the text.
Well, yeah, if we want to talk about personal identity for a minute. So we'll have an episode on this eventually. So Locke was very famous, John Locke, for his notion of personal identity, which is to say, we don't have to talk about a soul that exists over time that, you know, will be there around after my death. We can talk about personal identity just in terms of my own memory. And this is a very popular thing for fiction and sci-fi and things to play on, that like, well, what if I'm cloned? So there's two of me that have my memories. Are they both me? Or what if I lose my memory completely and I'm never going to get it back? Do I become a new person? There's sort of limit cases. And I think Hume was the one on top of that to say that really just like cause and effect are just mental. They're just mental habits.
Well, not mental, right? They're habits.
Well, they're habits of thought. What do you mean? They're not habits
Hume
within...
Hume isn't an idealist, right? He just says they're habits.
We're not going to have an argument about...
Yeah, do not get into an argument about Hume.
Okay.
But it's very similar to what is going on to Nagarjuna's analysis of causality that we should talk about that. It's not that they're objectively existing things in the world that are causing each other in a mind-independent way. Causality is something that we put together by looking at things that happen and join them in our mind. So Hume had a similar thing when it came to the self, that really the self is just a bundle, right? This bundle view of self. There's nothing substantial underneath it. It's a bundle of perceptions, a bundle of phenomena, that there's pain here, there's, you know, thought of this thing there. We can't make any conclusions about what ontologically underlies those things. That's just not part of our experience.
I'm glad you brought up the point about identity, because that's definitely part of it as well. I mean, we're talking about the idea of a self and entities and all that, but there is a section in here where he makes the point that recognizing emptiness is not just about you versus the external world. It's also an identity issue, where he says you now versus the you who was 6 years old. To get hung up on the question of identity, of whether or not this is the same person, is part and parcel of getting hung up on the idea that there's an external world and there's a you and a consciousness and a self and all that. It's all part and parcel of the same problem that he wants to let go of. So the issue of identity goes away just as much as the problem of the external world, the notion of the self, all of that all disappears. And there's one point where he says, how can we talk about this? Well, it's just inexpressible. It's like it's a mystery. And that's where he gets into the discussion of cause and effect. It is section 5 of the commentary to the Heart of Interdependent Origination.
This is another one in the PDF of 4 things. Part 2, section 3, section 5.
And I just confused.
Through the examples of oral instruction, a lamp, a mirror, a seal, a sun crystal, a seed, sourness, and sound.
So the example he uses here, this gets into cause and effect. And I feel like we're leading there. So he says, the master says something to the disciple. And in this case, the disciple learns something or gains something. Something was transferred from the master to the disciple. But in the transference, the master is not deprived of that thing. It's not as though there was anything substantial that was either physically or somehow metaphysically transferred from the one to the other. And he says that the master caused something in the student, but there was no transference of substance of any sort.
Right. Of course, they didn't have a complex notion of replicatable information or something at that point.
Right. But this is I don't know if metaphor is the right term. He gives a couple of other examples, but he says, in the same way, when you die, the mind does not transmigrate, which is essentially the transference of substance. There's no transference of substance of the mind from this life to the next life. But there is the rebirth and there is causality. So there's this idea that causality exists, or at least some form of causality exists. But by getting rid of the notion of entities or substances, as we think of it in a traditional ontology, there's this causality without transference. And he says, how do we talk about it? We can't. It's just inexpressible.
We just call it interdependent origination, or sometimes he just calls it dependent origination, where it's translated as.
Yeah.
Which is to say that, taking this back to personal identity, I think it's interesting. He has to come up with this concept of interdependent origination directly because he has this doctrine that there is no substantial self, right? There's not a soul that goes on, but yet he still believes in reincarnation. And these are both things that are in the Buddha's supposed realization during his meditative period. So he can't just say, we're going to reform that and we're going to throw out the idea of reincarnation, though maybe, you know, Zen or later folks might do that. But he has to give this other explanation, which is as hard as it is to Hume to say, if there's no substantial underlying self, how can then a personality seem to be passed along throughout our lives or something like that? It's going to be even harder for Nagarjuna to say how through one life to the next life, something is going to be passed along.
Or even as the point you make, even in this life, if there's no substantial self, how do you get from being a baby to a teenager, to an adult, into old age, and then death? There is something connecting and there is some sort of causal relationship, but there's no substance that's somehow underlying it that is, in this case, persisting, and in the case of, like, say, this transference of knowledge or whatever, somehow being transferred. I find this fascinating and incomprehensible at the same time.
I mean, it's interesting, too. I mean, they go ahead and they make this point again and again that, of course, we can't really speak about what is really going on, but then they do proceed to write several more books and commentaries on exactly that.
Let's do some of the causality stuff. I mean, there's some of it even right near the beginning of emptiness. Just to read a couple of the verses there. Let me start at 6. If the effect is existent, the cause will possess the effect. That means that cause and effect are interdependent. Just like something and nothingness are interdependent, neither the cause nor the effect can be metaphysically basic. So we talked about this in terms of the notion of substance, the way Descartes talks about it and Spinoza talks about it in our past episodes. Spinoza had an argument, for instance, that to be a substance, to be independently existing, means that you don't rely on anything else. That's what the definition of substance is that he got from Descartes, who I guess got that more or less from Aristotle. Right. And so if you look at that, it seems like nothing that we encounter in our ordinary life could be a substance because everything has a cause, for instance. So for Spinoza, then, the only thing that could actually be a substance ends up being God, who is this entity that underlies, encompasses everything else. It's really equivalent to the whole. The whole is the only thing that is actually existent. That is the only substance. Well, Nagarjuna has a very similar kind of argument. He doesn't come to the same conclusion that there's this one underlying thing, the whole, but he has the same kind of arguments against the individual elements, right? You can't have causality between substances. By definition, a substance is independent. And he even puts it the other way. It's not even that the effect is dependent on the cause, but the cause is dependent on the effect. He's a determinist here. He's saying, if you have the cause there, it's not that it can choose to bring about the effect or not bring about the effect. The effect comes out of the cause. I mean, that's the notion of cause and effect as being a hard, not nearly mental relation that is absolutely deterministic. So if you think about it in that way, it's not just a matter of, oh, the concept of cause. If you call this a cause, then you're implicitly saying there's also an effect there. But metaphysically, in terms of the existence, if this set of conditions is here, it will bring about the effect. So in other words, everything is dependent on at least something else. So nothing is independent, so nothing is a substance.
Right.
Yes. And additionally, part of the other issue with the concept of substance in this context, Mark, is that it leads you to want to find first cause. One of the things that's interesting about this is that if you think about it in terms of a chain of causality, once you get caught up in that cycle, you end up saying, well, we keep having to go back and go back and go back and go back until we find the unmoved mover and all, you know, all that sort of thing. He has a solution to that, which simultaneously embeds the concept of effect in the cause, just like you just mentioned, so that in theory, the concept of substantiality is not necessary. But it also basically says there is no first cause. And more importantly, it's a kind of weird kind of necessity that can't be talked about in terms of necessity. And what I mean by that is, you might say, okay, things interdependently originated, and they have this cycle of cause and effect. It's eternal and recurrent and blah, blah, blah. And you might say, well, what if they didn't interdependently originate? And you can't really actually even ask that question because you can't say, well, what if it didn't? What if there was no interdependent origination? Because then you're back to that same negation thing we talked about earlier. So in a weird way, it's like necessary without being able to be spoken of as necessary.
That's a really interesting idea whether one can do what he's trying to do here. And if one can do it, it seems to be a very different sort of metaphysics you get. You know, what I think of when I think about trying to understand all this is Quine. It's necessarily radically holistic.
Explain that.
I mean, one of these notions that comes up in contemporary analytic philosophy is in semantics, we can advocate either atomism, molecularism, or holism. Atomism being Russell's notion, this reductionist notion, that we can break the world up semantically into something like propositions. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have holists who say, no, you can't isolate any single proposition meaningfully. No proposition exists meaningfully independently of the whole body of propositions. So this will be Quine in what is two dogmas, I guess he does it or whatever. And he says, okay, you have to look at the whole theory of how we look at the world as a kind of web. And each of us is a semantic web of propositions that all hang together so that there is no isolating parts of the metaphysical universe. That's the only way to take Nargujana or Taoism or these kinds of philosophies where there's an ineffable truth that transcends all these things. And then we use these conventional kinds of terminologies and ideas and concepts to try and grapple and get at it. But we're always constricted by the fact that you can't really isolate out one part from another. Every idea derives its meaning from the whole body of ideas, of all the ideas.
Often Nagarjuna is read as a neo-Kantian. Westerhoff says this. Actually, around the time of Quine, there was a spate of Nagarjuna scholarship. And one of the common solutions to approaching him was to say he's just some sort of neo-Kantian, saying that, you know, all these notions of self and causality and all this, this is a human creation. It's a human systematic creation, as you say, that all the concepts kind of depend on all the other concepts. And let me just sort of finish the bit with Kant in there, that not only is it a matter that the cause and effect are essentially related to each other, so neither of them can be a substance because neither of them is independent, but the identification of cause and effect chains is a matter of the mind. And just like Hume, causality is something that we impose upon the phenomena. Nagarjuna is going to go farther than that and say, the concept of causality is not one that can be applied to reality independent of the mind. Talked about this with Kant in terms of the interaction of different faculties, like the sensibility that defines space and time, and then the understanding, which groups different perceptions into objects and talks about relations between them. All this kind of stuff for Nagarjuna is also, he doesn't divide it up in that way, but these are illusory, right? Space and time themselves are contributions of the mind.
Okay, but I want to jump in here because I want to say that Nargujan is also taking fire at this notion that it's actually incorrect to talk about we're imposing this structure on the world. And he says, no, it's not that either.
Idealism.
Right? Idealism. It's not that either. It's not that it exists independently, nor is it that we endow it with this structure. That the origin of that structure is something, you know, quite sublime.
Well, that's why I said neo-Kantian instead of Kantian. It's not that there's the objective world out there and then the mind tries to grasp it, which is sort of our traditional metaphysical view. It's that we are given the world, and to pick out then what the mind is putting into it and what is given by the world in itself is groundless. So you're right. He's not a psychologist. He's not an idealist in saying that everything is really just in our heads. Even talking about our heads, like you were saying, that if the self is an illusion, then talking about me imposing these things is itself.
Good. Exactly.
Doing that kind of Kantian philosophy is itself breaking the rule. It's imposing things on the phenomena that are not really there.
One question I do have while we're on the subject, you know, when he uses the term you, or he says mind, like when he talks about body and external world, I get it. But when he talks about mind and you, he says, the body and the external world affect the mind through afflictions and distractions, and that in turn affects you. Mm-hmm. The secret is for you to take control of your own mind, and then you will realize the impermanence and of afflictions and distractions. It's that language of mind and you, particularly given that there's no self.
There's no ultimate self.
There's no ultimate self.
A conventional self.
Let me read it to you. So, O fearless one, the blessed one said that the mind is the root of virtue. So discipline your mind. You are controlled by your mind, and in turn, your mind is subject to afflictions and distractions. No wonder you're unhappy and distressed. But if you could control your mind, then you could realize peace, happiness, and freedom. The mind is the key to radically changing your way of experiencing the world and your own state of being. The Buddha and Buddhist masters have always emphasized the importance of mind. Therefore, concentrate upon disciplining your own mind, and you will see a definite improvement in the quality of your life. So I don't know if that statement is something more along the lines of kind of like a psychological, or if it's more of a statement about when you take control of your mind and you change the way that you see the world, you can actually literally change the way that you see the world. Like, you will not experience it in the same way. You'll change the way in which you experience the world.
I think it's important that any reference to you or that kind of identity, the pronoun identity, is that who you're speaking to is not you as you know yourself conventionally, but as you might become in a more transcendent way. But it's necessarily conventional, for sure. The term mind, I would want to classify that as quasi-conventional. It's conventional in the sense that everything that one talks about with any of this stuff is conventional, but it's more scientifically defined. When they talk about mind, they have some very specific things in mind. On the one hand, they say, okay, there is no independent origination. There is no substance. There are no base substances. That's illusory. What you have, of course, is then everything is in some sense illusory, in the sense that insofar as it appears to be a substance, well, it's an illusion, it's not. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have certain kinds of logic, trends, that you can't break the stuff up into very basic parts, at least quasi-conventionally, because it's more than just meaningless convention. It's sort of scientific convention. It's like They've been working together on this, and they say, well, look, you know, we do seem to have six senses. That's their official notion of this. You know, you got your taste, you got your smell, you got your sight, you got your hearing, you got your feeling, and you got this mental sensation as well. Well, it seems that there is a certain amount we can say about how things are built so that we can talk about it. Mind has a very definite meaning in that sense. It's sort of a metaphysical reference to something like consciousness, but I don't think we've got a good term in English, actually, for what they mean. Mind is what you'll find when you remove a lot of other garbage, when you sit quietly and meditate.
There's enough of a talk of mind that you can talk about psychology, and that Tibetan version by David Ross Komito, it's subtitled, I think, A Buddhist Psychology of Emptiness. Elaborating some of the stuff that's near the end of Emptiness's 70 Stanzas, he talks about, you could say we have sense data. He doesn't use this term, and I'm really hesitant to bring it up because it's not from this tradition or anything. But we have these raw experiences. But we, as non-infants, break these down in certain ways, in the ways that Kant talked about. So we identify particular objects. We identify one moment as flowing from the previous moment. Even if we're not pointing out a specific instance of causality, just the persistence of objects over time is itself a mental creation. Why we don't see everything as just a chaotic flux. And he thinks that since all this is ultimately illusory, yes, it has a conventional reality to it, it is useful, but since they're ultimately illusory, I guess the first step to enlightenment is to intellectually understand why they're illusory. Once you get these intellectually in your head, then you sit and you meditate on them, and eventually you're able to condition your moment-to-moment perception so that you no longer impose svabhava, this inherent existence, this objecthood, this mind independence. You no longer impose that kind of stuff on your experience. So yes, he thinks that you can actually undo the Kantian contribution of the understanding and sensibility. And that's how, in fact, you obtain nirvana.
Yes. Nicely said.
Which is especially weird if you think about that in terms of space and time. Space and time are not really real. And if I can just stop seeing things in terms of space and time, it's almost like you've transcended space and time. I'm very much reminded of our discussion in the end of the second Spinoza episode of how you obtain immortality. If you think about man itself as a kind of Platonic concept and how you participate in that, and you make yourself more universal and reasonable, then it's like you're transcending your individuality, you're transcending space and time. Well, there's You know, it's a different psychological procedure, but it's a similar kind of gesture that you can be a one with the infinite by not seeing things in the ordinary manner.
That's interesting, that connection to Spinoza there. The terminology you said earlier, you said that they don't talk about raw sense data. Actually, they do. I don't know if Nagarjuna doesn't, but the Tibetans definitely do. I mean, they've really made a science out of this, and there's a whole pile of texts that have followed out of this tradition that do exactly that, where it becomes really a phenomenology. I know, for example, this idea that in the finest states, that if you sit and meditate for 20 years and really practice it, that you can get to a level where you're able to witness the matrix of our experience.
So you're saying through these meditative techniques, at least these other writers were coming up with these descriptions of experience that seem to indicate that they've gotten very closely in touch with seeing the experience itself and not imposing theories on it.
For example, yes.
I'm extremely skeptical of this whole claim that you can undo. First of all, it seems like it would be very hard if you actually did decondition your mind so that you were not seeing things as unified objects anymore. You were not seeing space and time as we ordinarily see them. It seems like it would be very hard to turn that on and off so that you would die very quickly. Like, there's a reason evolutionarily that we have these mental habits, these deceptive habits. I don't know. It just seems very utter bullshit to me. I'm not sure what to make of this.
I think that your position's pretty reasonable because it's like, you know, this is all very well, but when you build a bridge, you know, you better put structural beams in and cables and stuff or the thing will fall down. You can't just imagine the bridge working magically and then it'll work. I mean, there are these physical laws. Newton says bullshit. Newton says time passes the way it passes, space and time, and those things are absolute and you can't fuck with those things.
I'm not even arguing that. I'm saying, I mean, I understand that he can say, yes, there's a difference between pragmatic reality, which is what we study in science, the world of appearances. And of course, if you're going about to build a bridge, you have to build it according to the physical laws. But ultimately, you can change your mind so that you no longer see things that way. How could you do that and not just starve? I could understand how you could no longer see, say, your physical hunger as yours. Oh, there's no I. I is ultimately illusory. So this pain that is in the stomach area is somehow not ultimately mine, and I can choose to fast and ignore that, or I can choose to eat. I can gain this detachment. It seems there's a certain amount of self-deceptiveness about this. It says something valuable about our ability to conceive ourselves in different ways. And the self was a flexible concept. That's great to know.
But you're talking about a psychological, right? I mean, the assumption it's operating
yes.
there is that you're still bound to the physical universe.
Wait. So let's give a charitable reading to this for a second. One way is you can say, oh, well, if you sufficiently change your mind, then you're no longer subject to these laws. And then you get Super Buddha, like on South Park, who can fly through the air and shoot lasers out of his hands or whatever it is that he does. You know, the other way of reading it is to say, at no point did they say that you're not subject to the laws of physics or things like hunger, right? That when you change your mind, you know, you don't overeat, you don't get it tied to the idea of food, that I live to eat, not eat to live. Let's just say that there's some way to interpret this where you just say, okay, it's not about changing the physical reality or your perception of physical reality, but it's more about changing your perception of yourself inside of reality or what we think of as reality. My question is, what about everybody else? There's so much detachment. You know, don't think about your past. Don't worry about who you were. Don't worry about doing anything. Who's going to farm? When you extrapolate this and try to turn it into more of a societal concept, he's giving advice to a king, but if the king was truly enlightened, you get the sense that he wouldn't actually do anything. And it made me wonder whether there wasn't some notion that, well, this is really only for a select group. It's a very elite.
And it's for the advanced, definitely.
It's for the advanced. But you started off the podcast by pointing out that there was this work of trying to get everybody to this point. Is there any place where this role inside of a larger societal role is somehow explicated? Like, our goal is to have everybody virtuous, but only a few people enlightened? Or my bigger concern is not that you change the physical world or that you see the physical world differently. It's that you become completely useless.
That is what I was getting at about that it would be hard to go in and out of that mode of, I mean, you could see the no self, you could see that everything is illusory, but then you have to be able to snap out of that to go have virtuous action and help others. It seems that would be difficult.
You'd have to be a teacher, but you wouldn't be like a farmer.
But that's not actually so. For example, during the time of Buddha, Buddha was not the only one that was enlightened. As it turns out, that one of his disciples in particular, who was like the dishwasher or the rice beater or something, you know, really demeaning and low, was also enlightened. And only the Buddha knew that he was enlightened. So he was enlightened, hanging out with the congregation, the group, and making the rice or making the soup.
So this is similar in Taoism that you might not recognize the sage as such.
Very much. And in fact, I mean, you'll find authors of sort of talking about Zen who say, look, enlightenment's not even all that rare. There's a surprising number of people who are enlightened. They just don't make a lot of noise about it.
No, I understand that. I think there was a part in there, though, about the concept of being satisfied with what you've got. And maybe that was the part that I had trouble with. So I was thinking, well, if enough people get satisfied with what they have, then you're not going to get progress like science or
the good-hearted letter you're talking about still?
I believe so.
His ethical. It's a letter to a king of the time to say, here's how to act. So it's sort of elaborating what the Eightfold Path is in this respect. And there's a lot about no gambling and keep yourself pure and be nice to people.
Yes, I might have slipped from talking about the metaphysics to more of the ethics at this point.
It's okay.
So this is a huge question. I mean, what is the ethical position that one should take up, given that, let's say, Nargujana's metaphysics is correct, though I would hesitate to go there before at least saying I'm not convinced that if you really take Nargujana at his word and you really take a hard line on this, that you can accept the limitations that seem to be imposed by physical laws. And in other words, Buddha's firing whatever out their ass is entirely possible if you really take him at his word on this. I don't see the leeway there. I don't see a watered-down version of Buddhism where, well, it's psychological and, you know, you can just sort of get along with all the difficulties in life and so be happier. I mean, if you really accept the metaphysics of what he seems to be pointing at, then get ready to forget about the first law of thermodynamics.
I want to shift a little bit. So we already talked about emptiness. We talked about how cause and effect is not real, how the apparent mind independence of things is not real. In fact, I should also say, in terms of the non-foundationalist thing, because we said, well, Spinoza's solution is to say, okay, fine, these independent physical phenomenal things are not real, but there's a God, there's something underlying it that's real, and in fact, is the totality of everything. Well, Nagarjuna has an answer to that too. Two things. One thing, something can't cause itself. So if you say everything is caused by something except there's a first cause that causes itself, no, that's just cheating. The concepts of cause and effect themselves imply that something cannot cause itself. That's one of the things. The other thing is that nothing that is a composite could be metaphysically basic. And in the same way he critiques cause and effect, he critiques the whole and part relationship. That if you have something that is made up of things that are unreal, well, the totality, the composite of those is also going to be unreal. So you can't say, oh, well, it's the system of cause and effect together that's real or something, that's the fundamental substance. Or you can't say God is the totality of all the stuff and that's real, because if it's made up of unreal bits, it's not going to suddenly be real. To bring in something that I'm glad Wes is not on now, because he would jump on this immediately about, is Richard Dawkins. I finished his book, The God Delusion. A lot of his argument is against intelligent design. So if you say, look, there's a first cause that must have designed everything, is God, and God is simple. Metaphysically, somehow God is metaphysically simple. That's cheating. If you're going to have somebody that's complex enough to design stuff, then that thing has to be complex and will require an explanation itself. So just putting the word God on it and saying, oh, well, God, that solves the problem, doesn't solve the problem at all. You have the same exact problem you started with. So just to, I don't want to talk much about the Dawkins. I'm sure we'll bring that up and I'll give Wes a chance to beat
Can
me.
I just say one thing about Dawkins?
Go ahead.
Okay, I think he's a moron. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, substitute Wes. In any case, I think that it's a point well made that if you just say, like Spinoza does, that, oh, well, it's the totality of everything, yet it's an ultimately simple substance, you're cheating. You're just doing something silly with words. And so Nagarjuna is going to reject that too. So there is ultimately nothing, if you can't make these individual phenomenal things somehow metaphysically grounded, then you can't posit some underlying thing that is grounded as well. The only other option, which is considered in the Westerhof, and I didn't fully understand the response to it, is, well, what if there's an ineffable thing that grounds everything? It's what we don't understand, what we can't put into words. It's the Tao. What is his argument against that? And the best Westerhoff comes up. He says, look, this is not really in the Nagarjuna, but you can kind of figure out what Nagarjuna would say, which is something kind of like what the pragmatist would say, kind of like what the neo-Kantian I was saying would say, is that if something is inconceivable, then it doesn't exist. I guess you're going to say that's a bad thing to impute on any kind of Buddhist, Eric?
Well, no, I wouldn't say any kind of Buddhist. I'm just talking Nagarjuna here. He says, you know, it's not this, and it's not that, and it's not both this and that. But he doesn't say that it's not neither this nor that. He says that we can't say that it's neither this nor that. And this is a subtle shift, because when we start talking about the ineffable and stuff like that, the mode of discourse changes. It moves from the metaphysical to the semantic. He's not saying that there's not this ineffable thing. He's saying you can't talk about it. He's doing the Wittgensteinian thing. He's saying, you know, about that which we cannot speak, we must remain silent. But that doesn't mean it's not there.
Yeah, it just seems that he's different in that whereas Wittgenstein is sort of a virtual mystic and referring to these mystical things that we can't talk about, the Buddhist is going to say, if you are an enlightened being, you perceive whatever reality is directly. It's not just that you...
Yes, that's true.
I mean, part of it is that you recognize the emptiness of everything, but if there was something besides the emptiness, something that was ultimate reality, you would be in touch with that. That's
indeed
the definition.
Yes, they do. You're absolutely right. And it's kind of miraculous, and they spend a lot of time trying to explain how this could be possible, right?
Yes. And you would imagine that more time would be spent with the Taoists expounding the ineffability if really Nagarjuna was a believer in the ineffable.
Nagarjuna's project is, first of all, to clear away the riffraff. At least in the 77 stanzas, this is what he's really doing. He's trying to, first of all, clear the field, but then plenty of other people have gone on. I mean, the entire Tibetan tradition and everything that was ever written afterwards is, in some sense, an attempt at exactly that, of trying to articulate an affirmative account of the liberation.
Go read more, people, if you want to. Certainly, if Nagarjuna is not mystical enough for you, there are plenty of other people in this tradition that you'll find plenty of that. To jump again from emptiness, so we kind of covered, look, everything is empty. The part whole is empty. Self is empty.
Let's define emptiness really clearly, just so that we're not at all confused.
Okay. It lacks svabhava, right? And svabhava is this peculiar Sanskrit word that refers to inherent existence or existence from its own side, meaning apart from human comprehension or something like that. It is substance in Descartes' or Aristotle's sense. So emptiness is not having that, right?
Emptiness is what you have when you remove substances. So it's not nothingness, which is also a term that a lot of the stuff gets translated. It's very clearly, it's not nothing.
This is probably a good place to turn to the last couple chapters of Foundation Stances from the Middle Way, which was just the objection. So I'm looking at chapters 24 and chapter 25 of that other PDF.
Yeah.
We don't have to read through them all or anything, but it's considering an objection. It's to say, you're denying the real existence of all this stuff. Doesn't that undermine Buddhist teaching itself? So in this chapter 24, investigating of the ennobling truths, the objector says, hey, look, if all were empty, nothing would come about or perish. It would follow that the four noble truths do not exist. Therefore, understanding, letting go, cultivating and realizing would no longer be valid. This whole system that you've set out about how to attain enlightenment wouldn't make any sense. It wouldn't exist. His response to that is to say, look, that's actually also part of conventional reality. We only have to have the word emptiness, again, as an opposite to the notion of substance. But really, what reality is transcends that opposition in the way it transcends all the other oppositions.
Yeah.
He says that Dharma taught by the Buddha perfectly relies on two truths, the ambiguous truths of the world and the truth of sublime meaning. If you don't understand the division of those, you're not going to get it. Without relying on conventions, the sublime meaning cannot be taught. If their view of emptiness is wrong, those of little intelligence would be hurt. Like handling a snake in the wrong way or casting a spell in the wrong
way. That's a good one, isn't it?
Which, again, I think this is just responding to what Seth was saying before about ethics, that you got to realize that there's a lot that you still have to do because conventional existence, even if it's only conventional, it matters. Attaining your own enlightenment is only half of the story for the Mahayana Buddhist. It's helping everybody else, which requires making sure they're not hungry and miserable and diseased.
I think also another thing about this, Mark, is that the claims that they make about morality are that acting morally or virtuously, which seem to be used interchangeably in this text that we looked at, definitely is part of the path, that you can't be immoral or unvirtuous and somehow attain enlightenment. The natural conclusion from everything is empty, which is nothing matters and to do nothing, doesn't follow. This is why you need the doctrine of interdependent origination. Emptiness in itself is not going to give you any basis for making any kind of claims about morality, but somehow interdependent origination is, and the concept of liberation from that. Like, if you're going to get liberated from affliction, there's some implied normative scheme there, whether you agree with what they come up with or not. And then the other part of it is, if you have the cycle of rebirth, and this is part of the path, there are going to be people who live their lives that could never attain this state, the elevated state. And they're just going to be farmers and kings and factory workers and ex-philosophy students and whatever. And you want to have a good life in that space too. You know, if you're just going to be one of those people that has to get along with everybody else and not be a Buddha or not attain enlightenment or bodhisattva or whatever all those terms are, the bottom line is you kind of want to get along with everybody and you want to have a good life. And these are the kinds of things that are informed by what the concept of enlightenment brings, namely generosity, patience, doing things with energy and concentration, and then things that are contrary to that. Like, I think there are 10 non-virtuous actions. We actually have a 10 commandments in the letter to the king. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, which is kind of ambiguous, lying, slander, malicious speech, idle talk, covetousness, malevolence, and erroneous views. There is this morality, but it's not the morality of emptiness. It's the morality of rebirth and interdependent origination. I'm sympathetic, obviously. I think we're all sympathetic to the fact that there is, but...
To having ethics.
We're all sympathetic to that. But at the same time, I don't know how much work it would take to actually figure out how all that comes about. Just because it just seems that so much of this stuff is forbearance and acceptance and a kind of passive approach to things, then understanding forgiveness, the kind of what we would typically consider kind of the moral basis for a lot of these types of actions.
I think it would be fair to say that most of what we would call morality and ethics is at the very least is conventional. If there is a part, a slice of it that extends to the sublime, then it extends to the sublime only insofar as the sublime and the conventional are distinct, which they're not really, but insofar as they appear to be and insofar as they are conventionally distinct. And in that context, compassion is one of the most important qualities of a searcher, of a seeker of the enlightenment, of a monk, of a nun. But having said that, you could be a really evil son of a bitch, but you could still get enlightened. It is not necessary for enlightenment. You know, on the ethical level, there's several cases like this where enlightenment can happen even though you're really very unfriendly and very unkind.
What you're saying is that you can be non-virtuous in the conventional world and still achieve enlightenment.
Absolutely.
So what does a Buddhist tell a regular person? These are the things you should do and these are the things you should avoid. On what basis are they making those claims?
There's an operative subtlety here that makes simplistic ethical schemes, well, it's just not simple. It's very subtle.
How would it be subtle if it's all illusion, but yet conventional reality? Are you saying that there's more than one way to form your mind such that you'll be able to recognize nirvana, and the eightfold, you know, making yourself a good monk is sort of the easiest one to explain, but there's other ways? Is that getting at all what you're saying?
Well, I mean, look, the point I bring this up is that I think that if you put too much weight on this eightfold path that you miss, I mean, you get into a very, you know, kind of pedantic and dogmatic form of Buddhism that is not the much more subtle views that have been expounded. And look, it's not hard and fast like that. You don't have to follow the eightfold path. All you have to do is wake up.
But that's not what I'm asking for here, right? This goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning. If somebody says to you, this is the right way to act, this is what it means to be virtuous, and being virtuous is good for a particular reason, it makes sense. And forget about the words ethics or morality or whatever. Somebody tells you this is right action and this is wrong action, and you say, why? There are an innumerable number of responses to that, because it will make you happy. because it's moderation, and moderation is what's good because God told us to do it. All I'm asking for is, if enlightenment is not the reason for virtuous action, because most people will never be enlightened, what is the justification or the motivation for acting virtuously according to the Buddhist?
Isn't it just karma? It's the same as the pre-Buddhist answer. It's that you're going to be in a hell in your next life or come back as a bug or something.
Like what you said, why does the Dalai Lama say nonviolence is better? Why does the Dalai Lama say we should not shoot the Chinese? Like, what is his reason for saying that?
Yeah, that would be one example.
I would say, you know, for the most part, we're not going to get anywhere if we try to. There's going to be different answers from different Buddhist priests at different times for different cultures and different contexts. But in terms of sort of the hard ethics underlying it, we need to speak in a different way.
I mean, I get it. So one answer is, well, there's lots of different reasons for doing this, that there's not, just in the same way that you don't go back to a first cause that grounds everything, because there's this interdependent origination, there will be no sense in looking for a ground because everything is interconnected and there are a number of different ways to explain this. One way might be that you will be unhappy if you act unvirtuously in this life, and that one of the things you might want is to be happy. Well, to be happy means to be generous, loving, compassionate, joyful, etc. Another is that at some point you may want to get to the point where you achieve enlightenment, and that will only happen if you take these steps. And if you're saying, look, there's lots of different ways, that's fine. That's an answer. But that is the answer. I'm just looking for an answer of why should I do what you tell me to do? Or what is the justification for saying that this type of action is right and this type of action is wrong? And if it's, hey, there's actually 17 reasons because everything's interconnected and it's not as simple as we have the one substance or the unmoved mover and all that kind of stuff that grounds all this, that's okay too.
So in fairness, I guess, I mean, I would say what you can say is that there is an operative norm. The norm is that things that are in the direction of enlightenment are better, and things that are away from enlightenment and more into confusion, ignorance, and samsara are worse.
Bringing up enlightenment and nirvana again, let me pull this back to one other part near the end of the foundation stands of the middle way. So right after the chapter 24 that we talked about why should we care about the Eightfold Path, which is what got us on this discussion, is 25 is the investigation of nirvana. And he goes into, look, nirvana is not a thing. If it was a thing, then it would be conditioned. It would have the characteristics of aging and death. It would have a cause. So nirvana can't be something like that. But if it's not a thing, it's not a no thing either. The opposite of a thing or something. And that's still sort of on the same playing field as thingness. So it somehow has to be completely off of this. And then where this gets crazy, this is down verses like 17 through 20 here. So after the Bhagavan has entered nirvana, one cannot perceive him as existing, likewise as not existing, nor can one perceive him as both or neither. So you're not in an existent state, you're not in a non-existent state. Even when the Bhagavan is alive, one cannot perceive him as existing, likewise as not existing, nor can one perceive him as both or neither. Then here's the kicker, number 19, samsara, the whole muddled mess of rebirth and the things of our experience. Samsara does not have the slightest distinction from nirvana. Nirvana does not have the slightest distinction from samsara. Yeah. Whatever is the end of nirvana is the end of samsara. There's not even a very subtle, slight distinction between the two.
The use of the terms samsara and nirvana distinguish now the universe into two parts. I mean, these terms that samsara is defined as that which is not nirvana. Nirvana is defined as that which is not samsara. And then you have it.
But he's saying
now that there's no difference between them in the slightest
way. Right. That you can't, right. If you oppose them in that way, then you must be talking about the things of experience, but no, this is supposed to be getting at something other than that. So I think it's a way of saying that it's not like chaining nirvana is like going to heaven, that like here's a place and then you go to another place. And you can't think of it temporally, that everything was going on. There was the samsara, and then you somehow ascend to another dimension, and thereby samsara ceases. No, it's not that either. Somehow these are overlaid with each other, which I guess one of the ways I could read this is the way we were talking, that somebody that has obtained nirvana, maybe they don't even look any different from anybody else. Because, I mean, if this is really, it's a matter of mentally switching the way that you are looking at things. Ah, ha, I'm in nirvana now because I have different mental habits of checking out things. Then in a way that you could say it's sort of coextensive with samsara. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but that's one of the only ways I can try to make sense of this weird thing.
The way that I make sense of it is by noting that nirvana and samsara are conventional terms, that this is on the level of semantics, that it makes sense to make the distinction in certain contexts, like when you're recruiting new monks, but that is a temporary. It's only useful in a certain context, right? So
yeah, actually, that's exactly the chain I wanted to get. The big thing that was interesting in the reasoning of the 60 stanzas, I mean, he does a lot of the same stuff about the difference between conventional and ultimate reality and things. But toward the end of it, 36 is, as long as there is movement of the mind, so long one will be in the domain of Mara, which is samsara, essentially. So it's this movement of the mind, the fact that you're sort of looking between opposites, the fact that you're distinguishing these things at all, that is a form of ignorance. So the next part, the world has ignorance as a condition because the Buddha has proclaimed it to be so. Therefore, why is it not justified that this world be the effect of conceptualization? Right? So conceptualization itself is ignorance. We've kind of been saying this before. Remember the components of your argument, like the distinction between nirvana and samsara, those are ultimately empty too. It's not just physical objects in front of us. It's anything that we conceive of. Even these abstract concepts like nirvana, those too are empty. So that's kind of a kick on the, there's a lot of kind of elitist language. We saw it in the Taoism. Whenever you have talk of enlightenment, there's like the superior man does this and this, the sage does this and this, and then those ignorant puds, they're below that. But No. We need to even get beyond that. We need to understand that just holding the right view, that I intellectually understand that all of this is emptiness, even the concept of emptiness itself, the adherence to a view that I am of the Madhyamika school, this too has to be overcome if you're really going to attain enlightenment. We've been talking throughout about the emptiness of physical phenomena, but it's the emptiness of ideas as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right.
If the acceptance of entities is present, the terrible erroneous views will arise from which attachment and ill will originate. From the latter, disputation will arise. There's a direct connection between our attachment to physical objects, to the notions of self, this kind of stuff, and to views. Philosophical views says that the acceptance of entities is the cause of all views. Without it, the afflictions will not originate. Therefore, if this is known, views and afflictions will be thoroughly purified. The process of clinging and disputation will originate from the attachment for those who are dominated by the false cognition that is the grasping at the unreal as real. This is what really, I think, is why this was so influential on Zen in particular. It's not just that the unreality of thing, it's don't get yourself attached to views. If you are a part of a philosophical school, that too will keep you chained in your regular everyday way of seeing things, even if the view itself is supposedly a radical anti-establishment one.
I think that you're absolutely right, and that is why Nargujjana takes on this philosophical project to try and get at the root of these misconceptions in that way.
Seth, does that make any sense to you at all, or is that just self-defeating?
Well, it doesn't make any sense to me, but how different is that from, you know, what we discovered when we read Wittgenstein, when we looked at the Tractatus, and it was, oh, and by the way, everything you just read, you're going to have to throw away in order to be able to understand. It brings to mind, and this is going to kind of lead me in, I'm going to make my closing comments here. There's always an element in the interesting philosophies that we look at, for the most part, where you get to a point that language doesn't suffice. You get to the question of the way that can be shown is not the way, or that there's some kind of experiential component that we need to take into account because what we need to talk about cannot be talked about right now. Or maybe it's, we need to develop the language for it. We don't have the language for it right now. Or maybe it's we need to escape the language we have because the language we have is caught up. There's always some struggle with the way concepts and thoughts are expressed and communicated and this idea that we have to wrestle with that fact. And so that to me, I see as just kind of like another iteration of that. But it's also something that when you talk about a concept of enlightenment and there being this state that I can talk to you about, but you won't understand it until you're there. You know, you have to see it to believe it or see it to understand it kind of thing. And in this case, it's actually structurally sort of formally taken out of the whole notion that it can be demonstrated or shown or proven because you've gotten rid of the whole substance ontology that underlies things like predicate logic and all that sort of thing. So this is really alien in that respect, or I should say more formally alien than other things. That's definitely one thing. Another question I have then is, why is this so antithetical to what I would say is our common sense way of seeing things? most languages, or I think certainly most Western languages, have a grammar of the I, even though the concept of self that we all live with is something that kind of got invented by Descartes. The idea of an I or a self of some sort has been around and is definitely part of our Western tradition and the language we use with tense and subject, I, we, you, us, them. Mm-hmm. It lends itself to exactly what the Buddhist is saying, where we have to escape. I find that interesting in itself. You would think that if this is something that was so desirable, or maybe that's the structure of things, we should be funneled towards suffering because enlightenment is this thing that's so alien and different. And then third thing was that I was just listening. There's a radio show in England called Little Atoms, and they released mm-hmm. the radio show as a podcast, which I listened to. And they had an author on recently who noted that the concept of zero and the actual sign, the circle that we use to indicate zero, as in a count of none, came from India around 400 AD. And that, in fact, the Romans and the Roman numeral system did not have a concept of no thing or zero. And it specifically mentioned, he talked about it in terms of Hinduism, but he basically said that the Indian philosophers and thinkers invented the concept of nothingness and emptiness, and they required a sign for it. And of course, if you want to use that in mathematical expression, and it actually spread from India through the Arab world when the Arabs were kind of at their peak intellectually, reading the Greeks when sure. Western Europe was in their ages, which I found fascinating and interesting. But it sort of belies that. It comes back to the idea of you need to have a concept, but the concept needs to be empty. You need to have an empty concept of the concept of emptiness in order for it to originate but not be originated. I'll just leave it at that.
Do you have any closing, Erics? That's not merely just saying how inadequate this discussion was because it's only 2 hours long and focused
actually,
on a finite amount of
actually,
stuff.
Actually, I think that we've had a remarkable, a surprisingly good conversation is how I feel about surprisingly good, actually.
I blame the absence of Wes.
I'm not going to go.
The no Wes.
I miss Wes.
It's not just,
I miss Wes.
It's just not that he's not here. It's that the not Wes is here.
I guess I'd like to say that Seth's points are, I think, quite relevant and important, especially the notion of language, the relationship between the development of a concept like zero in terms of how we engage with these ideas. And that for me personally, I wouldn't say I'm a Buddhist, but I'd say I've been very influenced by Buddhist thinking. But I have to get off the train, Nargujana's train, for example, precisely on some of these kinds of points that the conventional world is very sticky and that things like the laws of physics and the way language seems to operate and seems to have to operate, which is bigger than just as it happens to operate. Having said that, Nargujana contributed enormously to a deeper intellectual understanding of things. Most of the theories and ideas that we have about the world and what's right and wrong and what it's made of and how it works presuppose a kind of a semantic arrogance that I don't think is justified. And I think that Nargujana has done a really excellent job of bringing that into focus. It's another way of saying that I'm a semantic anti-realist. This sort of idea that we're going to be able to not just know, but to express, you know, using mere language, ultimate truths of the world is absurd.
I think you have added greatly to our understanding of this, and I'm glad, as usual, that we've got you on to be our slightly more knowledgeable voice in this Eastern philosophy area.
Yes. Yeah. I thought this was really good. I thought this was really good discussion. I appreciate you participating.
Oh, well, really my pleasure.
My overall problem with this is perhaps that the notion of svabhava, of independent existence, might be a straw man. If he wants to argue against our everyday conception of objects as being objective, does that really require that the objects be objective in the strong sense that they be completely independent of everything? Because he derives conclusions from that if you had something that was entirely independent of everything, It could not participate in causal relationships. It could not be even notionally compared to other things in the way that all of the concepts we think about are. That's a very extreme view of the independent existence of something. It just seems like if you have a more modest view, then maybe his arguments aren't going to be particularly strong against that. I mean, it's almost he's picking such a weak target that he can make that attack again and again and again and again in so many ways, but it comes down to a very simple objection to this concept of svabhava, which, again, I'm not convinced completely corresponds to something that we care about.
I like, by the way, Mark, I like the way that I say, like, well, let me kick off my summary, and yours is, the problem I have with this. It's always Seth the conciliatory one. And
well, let me say goodnight to the folks. Hey, everybody, next time, we're going to talk more about philosophy of art. We're going to talk about Nelson Goodman, a modern, only recently deceased philosopher. His book, Ways of World Making. You can look on partiallyexaminedlife.com for maybe a little more information of what chapters to focus on then. We're going to have a special actual artist as a guest, Jay Bailey. As soon as this episode is posted, we will post some supporting things about some of the tangents that came up in this discussion, some other stuff that we find on Buddhism in general, on Nagarjuna. There's just a lot happening on the blog these days. So again, check out partiallyexaminedlife.com. If you got a chance, go on iTunes, give us a positive review or a review. You can buy a t-shirt. And with that, enjoy the emptiness of existence and good night.
Good night.
All right, this is not Eric saying good night.
Sometime after failure has hit you again, and you can't keep on working for art or for pleasure, plus indulging yourself just doesn't hold your interest, and there's not much to know. It doesn't keep fading, and after your aims have been thoroughly trounced, and you don't really think they were worthwhile anyway, you'll be looking for something to fill up that hole, something worth waking up for. Do what I do, praise be to you. I live only for love enduring. There's nothing in this world but you, nothing in my world but you. I'm betting all my energy that you won't be wrong for me. There's nothing in my world but you, nothing left but me and you. Nothing left to motivate or even to make me real. I don't think you'll go for posterity. It's not worth it, it's not worth it. I don't think you'll put all your stakes on your friends, though that's a little closer to the heart. I know you can't stomach some Jesus or goddess, and immersion in politics is like dining with idiots, something that can't be kept up long. I know you want money, but not that much. I know you can't feel with a casual touch. You've got no addictions I know of, so baby, please consider me. After the madness of now goes away, whatever you do and wherever you pray, and even if you never feel as crummy as I often do, do what I do, praise be to you. I live only for love endearing. There's nothing in this world but you, nothing in my world but you. Betting all my energy that you won't be wrong for me. There's nothing in this world but you, nothing left but me and you. Nothing left to motivate or even to make me real.